Welcome to Law Subscribed. This is your dedicated news source for all things subscriptions and the law. My name is Matthew Kerbis. I'm the subscription attorney, and I believe subscriptions can help bridge the access to justice gap and incentivize attorneys to modernize and scale their practice like never before. In this episode, I interview Matthew Stevens. Matthew is the founder of Provider Legal, where he uses the subscription model to represent doctors, dentists, and other smaller medical practices. Provider Legal is a great example of using a powerful and definitive brand name coupled with a subscription model and a niche that can result in a successful and sustainable law practice. I record many of these months in advance, and since interviewing Matthew, I've been suggesting to inquiring attorneys for months that they check out Provider Legal as a prime example of how to do subscriptions right for legal services. Thank you to my sponsors, 650 and Gavel, links to both in the show notes, more on them later, and remember, please use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED when signing up. It lets them know you found out about them from the podcast, you get 10% off, and it really supports the show. For subscriptionseminar.com. I'm still taking firms off the waitlist one at a time in the order they signed up, so sign up now to get your spot in line. I'm an active participant in this process, helping you use the subscription model so I could only work with so many at a time since I am also still a practicing attorney. This podcast is finally getting more traction, so please rate and review it if you haven't already to help others discover the show. This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only, and nothing said is legal, ethical, or financial advice. Without further delay, here's the episode. Matt Stevens of Provider Legal, I'm so thrilled that you reached out, and I'm so happy to have you on Law Subscribed. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's a great podcast. I've been really excited listening to it over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, we met because Alex Hsu has a Substack, and I commented on it because he asked people to share what they do. And you saw it and you reached out, which I'm so glad you did, because there's not many of us subscription attorneys out there.
You know what? When I saw that, I was like, oh, there's someone like me. Like, I almost had a small tear just dramatically go down my cheek a little bit, because it can feel isolating. Like, it can feel, what's crazy is it's not even that weird. It's not that strange of a thing to do. Like, for lawyers, like for innovation in general, we're only moving the needle, like not very much, but wildly innovative, because we're in legal and that's how we work.
Right, right. But so anyway, so now since I know who you are, just go ahead and give yourself a little bit of an intro for my listeners.
Sure. So my name is Matt Stevens with Provider Legal. We do in-house counsel work or fractional in-house counsel work for mental, dental, and medical offices. We don't represent hospitals or plans. We're philosophically opposed. And that's the phrase that I use to describe our services to clients. We don't do hourly work because we're philosophically opposed to it. It's been great. We love this practice area. It's complicated, it's difficult, and it's full of people that definitely need help.
Yeah. And it's a niche, but it's also a broad niche, right?
Yeah. It's a niche as to client type more than anything else. And they have a specific set of needs and anxieties that need addressing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you didn't magically just start your practice with the subscription model. Something came first, right? So how about you get us started with that early journey of your legal career?
Yeah. So what's strange about me is I've always actually been in-house counsel. Like, that was my first job out of law school.
Wow.
And I'd wanted to do healthcare for a little while. I'd done a ton of externships and internships, and none of them got me anything. But I did have some experience, and I understood some pieces of how healthcare fraud worked. And so I worked as in-house counsel, and I moved from one company to another. And in one of those companies, I was like, you know, my boss doesn't really know what I do. And every time I try to explain it to him, like, the eyes glaze over like in 3-4 minutes. And this person is 100% in charge of whether or not I can pay rent. I really, really need to diversify my risk here, and I should get some more clients. And if I just had 4 or 5, then I would feel better. Like, okay. If one idiot drops me, that's fine. But being in-house counsel is like, you're in a marriage. Like, you're in it. You're in it every day. And it's tough to be married to a moron.
Well, so, I doubt they're listening to this podcast.
No, I don't think he is. But if he is, I hope he enjoys it. No, he's fine. It's just, like a lot of CEOs, they have a difficult time assessing a level of risk if it's outside of their area of expertise. Mm-hmm. And if they want, they can always get advice of, yeah, it's fine, which doesn't always work out for everyone.
Yeah. Well, that is an interesting journey to go from in-house to, you know, firm owner, It's not something that I've typically seen because most, I mean, I did interview a long time ago when I was getting ready to take the bar. I did interview with an in-house opportunity, but that was exceedingly rare.
Yeah.
And so what was it? So then you've never had to bill time. Is that right?
I have never had to bill time. And every time, like, I went to a third-tier law school, so I didn't go, like, once I found out that I had a C-plus in my first torts exam, I was like, well, there goes me being in the top 10%. Damn, I really wish I could have figured that out, but I didn't. And so I had to, like, figure out a way to, like, make my own way. And I desperately wanted to be in one of those, like, very niche healthcare law firms. And I had a couple of interviews, and they didn't pan out. But by the same token, I'm so grateful they didn't. Like, I'm yeah. really grateful. I ended up in-house as an accident because they had a major issue. And they're like, hey, we should they were at that cusp of where it made sense to bring someone in-house mm-hmm. to build a compliance program for them. What it's meant for my career is that it's really isolating. And I'm very, very nervous about my work product sometimes. So I chapter and verse, like, everything just so that I know that I feel secure in it. But the rationale for it was really that of, like, oh, I need to create some risk. I have kids, and spending the summers in wherever I happened to be general counsel wasn't really fun for them. So I wanted some flexibility. And I like the in-house counsel model. I think it works effectively. The door is open and people come in and tell you problems that no lawyer ever hears. And if you have a good relationship with those key staff, they'll tell you stuff before it becomes an issue.
Right.
And the dumpster fire that is the most legal professions work, like, is just completely avoided. And I'm like, oh, well, we should just do this all the time.
Subscription model equals problem avoidance. But it's not, just in case, because I try to have evergreen episodes that you could go back and listen to this even years from now. So if you're a law student and you're listening to this and it's after the year 2023, U.S. news was a thing that used to exist.
Right.
And so when Matt says tier three law school, he just means in the old ranking system, back when that was something that actually we pretended mattered, even though it didn't. And so just, you know, for context purposes, to keep this evergreen. me too. I think I was my school was tier two barely when I started. And then it became tier three as I was in law school. And I was in the same situation where as soon as I didn't have a TV, I didn't have video games. Like, I was study my first semester of 1L year. And then I got my grades. I was like, oh, I'm going to need to network.
Turns out soft skills are something I should acquire. That's what my grades are telling me.
They're like the most important skills for building a book of business, though.
Oh, by far. By far. I did sales before this, and I did technical sales. And when I moved in law school, I just wanted something more complicated and interesting. It has served me incredibly well. I had lived in Utah and had done a sales job for a while there. And I had left for law school. I was like, ah, so glad to get out of this state. And then my ex and my kids moved up here and I ended up in Utah. And I'm like, huh, here I am back in Utah, worrying and thinking about sales every day. Really can't escape this little zeitgeist I'm in. No, but it's the leap from in-house counsel to starting your own firm is actually not that bad, because you practice law in almost the exact same way. You're just doing it for as many people as you think you can handle. And it gave me the opportunity to actually think about how do I handle these vast array of different assignments that just change from one thing to the next, and how do I systematize that in a thoughtful way? Mm-hmm. And that's been, I think, the funnest part of owning my own practice.
And yeah, I went through this recently, but where did you go to figure out how do I even start a law firm?
I think I actually Googled how do I start a law firm. I actually think I Googled it. How, as embarrassing as that sounds, and I had a couple. So I'd had one large client that I had started out with that was like my mainstay for a long time, and it was not in healthcare. And I had worked, and there were this family group that had bought some greenhouses, and they're refurbishing them into cannabis, and then all of a sudden they had many compliance concerns and tenants that were moving in. So I those were my, that was my first initial big client. And I really wanted to build a niche around like second, third generation immigration or second or third generation businesses where they had passed it on to their kids and they were large enough. And they're like at that cusp where it didn't make sense to pay, you know, 95 to 115 for an in-house counsel, but I could charge them 40 or 50 and they'd be thrilled. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't quite make that work for whatever reason. And then I had had a couple of healthcare clients that I'd helped with various problems just here and there, and I'd build them hourly. And I'd had one client in particular who I became friends with, like good friends. We were talking kind of a lot. I helped him with his contract. And then he just kept calling me for like every little thing. And I didn't want to bill him because he was a friend of mine. Like we had had drinks together, but there were 2 minute conversations. And I'm like, well, I don't really want to mess with my life billing this. I'm in the middle of rock climbing. I don't want to bill him. But I am still annoyed that I'm getting all of his phone calls. But I would be much less annoyed if he gave me $200 a month. And so I said, hey, this is what we're doing for the next 6 months. Let's try it out. And he's like, ah, fantastic. Now I don't feel awkward and I can call you. And I said, yeah, go ahead. And so I just have been doing iterations of that since that time. Mm-hmm. And then going up market as much as I think sort of makes sense at the time. But that's really where it came from, was just this desire to be able to talk with clients as if they're human beings, as opposed to a billable unit. And it just irritated the hell out of me when I was in house counsel and people asked how my day was. I was like, no. Like for the two lawyers on the phone, this is $1,200 an hour. I work for a nonprofit. You don't get to ask me how my day is. We go straight to business. Mm-hmm. Like we're not talking, like we're not hanging out. We're not friends. At $1,200 an hour, no one's my friend.
Right. Right. And that seems to be the most common genesis of somebody's desire to say, this isn't right. What are my options? And so we're exposed to the subscription model in everyday interactions in today's world. So is that sort of why you decided I was going to use the subscription model, just because you've seen it used in other industries? Because certainly at the time that you launched it, there were very few people like attorneys outspoken about using it.
You know what? No, it wasn't other industries. It was me saying to myself, no, I like my job. I like being in-house counsel. I like being the guy that they go to when they think they have a fire. And I just wanted to recreate that experience as much as I possibly could. So when I built Provider Legal, I didn't really think about restricting the amount of work. I mostly just said, well, I can guesstimate how much work this is going to be. And I just want to be the person that they talk to and trust with their problems. And so I was just trying to recreate my job, just have more than one boss so I couldn't get fired.
Right. Yeah. That's great. So your clients that you're representing, have they previously had to hire lawyers and pay them a billable hour rate before they hired you?
Yes and no. So I have some very small clients and some larger clients. My small clients, I'm typically like their first or second, maybe third interaction with a lawyer, but they're often in like different areas. Like they got divorced or something. They don't often have like a business lawyer that they've talked to. And so there's some expectation setting as to how things work with that group of people. Mm-hmm. The people I sell best to, Matt, like the people that I do very well with, are people that have had attorneys before and have paid 40 or 50 grand. And I say, no, you're large. That's what I'm going to bill you ballpark per year. And they're like, and they almost don't believe me most of the time, but like a few months in, I'm like, no, like we're done. Like I charged the credit card and now we're done. We don't have to talk about this anymore. Like we're not having billing conversations. We're just talking about your problems. So those people are the easiest to sell to, because they have had just because the legal industry does have the sale for me. And then believe it or not, I actually have a client. Where was he from? I think the last place he practiced medicine was Austria, I think. And he said, oh yeah, this is how they sell legal services in Austria. It's just like an insurance policy, like, but for everything. It's for all of your general corporate matters. It's not just for malpractice. And I was like, well, this is that. So just buy this. And he's like, yeah, great. Sounds fantastic. Can't wait to sign up.
Yeah. Yeah. It's certainly a like a paradigm of like American legal culture that you bill your time. And in a lot of professional industries, consultants bill their time, you know, certain CPAs, you know, bill time. They do flat fee, but they also do, if they're doing different advising, they'll bill time. I had another attorney on at the time that this airs. His interview will have aired, Lyndon Renwick, who's an attorney from Australia who came to the U.S. and got licensed here and started practicing law. And he does fractional in-house. I think he calls it like outhouse counsel. It's like what the name of his company is, which and, you know, it has Lovely. two potential meanings in the U.S., but it works for him. And he's selling time in prepaid packages, which is different. But he's also like some of your clients, he's serving institutional clients who are used to paying by the hour, but they're also still happy to know I'm only paying for 10 hours a month, 20 hours a month, or 40 hours a month. And they sort of can better anticipate that. So it's like a half step to the subscription model because he's still tracking time. So when are you doing any kind of tracking of your time, even though you're not billing your time?
Yes and no. So not as specifically as I'd like. That's one of those things that we're working on to try to get better at. But we split things up into projects, and we try to make, we've tried to define the type, because it's in-house counsel. Mm-hmm. Like it's not like family law where it's like, well, you're either adopting or you're getting divorced. Like those are really the two things that we're doing. And it's either contested, uncontested, and there's a very... It has nuance, but it's a fairly linear process. With in-house counsel, it's, hey, these are the things proactive that we're doing to mitigate risk that we try to put a lot of emphasis on. And then this is the stuff that we're doing reactively. And so for me, what we wanted to do was just categorize what kind of work we were doing and then put it into buckets that were as close to one unit as possible in terms of time. So we track the number of projects that come in, and we track it, and we're, this quarter, we're hoping to do it on a per client basis. But in general, we track how much is coming in and how much is going out. And we use this project as a unit, and it's decent. It's not perfect. Some projects take longer than others inherently, but that's how we started measuring it, as to what is the volume of work and what is the type of work. Because I need that to say, okay, great, how can I subdivide this to make it more efficient? Mm-hmm. Which I don't think any other, except for a subscription law firm, nobody else is motivated to do it.
Right, right. Efficient doesn't, that word doesn't exist in the lexicon of billable hour lawyers, right? And so like but you're incentivized to do that when you're not billing your time, which this is a perfect example of. So going back to your two types of clients, your clients where they've never hired like a business lawyer to help their business before, versus the clients who used to pay billable hour at more expensive rate. Let's first look at the ones who've never had to hire a business lawyer before. Do they like the model? Like, what has been their feedback? Like, what sort of feedback have you gotten from them?
Generally, everyone likes the model. Like, both sides do. But the people that are new, I think most providers know, like, whether you're in not so much dental, but certainly medical and mental health, they have fairly high anxiety. And given the landscape of insurance reimbursement, False Claims Act, Stark, but really just dealing with insurance and just the utter choke chain that they have on a practice's revenue, depending upon their policies, gives my clients a lot of anxiety. And most of them are just like, I'm just glad I have someone to talk to. Mm-hmm. Like, because they don't know what's actually a problem, and justifiably, like, they should know quite a bit about how to excise my gallbladder out of my body. They should know that very well. I want them to know that very well. Like, I don't want someone taking ChatGPT or whatever it is through med school. Like, I really want them to know what they're doing. But the problem is because they've always been the smartest kid in the classroom, like since they were eight, is that they feel very uncomfortable starting a business. And it's very difficult to admit that to anyone. And I have conversations where they're like, ah, okay, finally, I can like level with someone and be like, yo, I don't actually know what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I get to have those conversations with my clients a lot more frequently than I ever had, even as in-house counsel.
Right. Nor should they know what they're doing on the legal side of things. Their zone of genius is medicine.
How would they know? It's right. Like me going like anytime you hire a professional, like, I don't know how cars work. I'm fairly certain, though, that a carburetor does not need to be polished. Like, I'm pretty sure that's not a thing. But to have somebody that I'm like, oh, okay, great. You're not billing me fee for service. You're not billing me by the hour. You're just like going to take care of my car. And like, great, I'm going to come to you if it's broken. Mm-hmm. It makes for such an easier relationship because they're working and handling it for me. And they're incentivized to keep my car running nice and smooth. And right. For me, that's what I want. I, Like, I don't want to deal with any sexual harassment claims. So for damn sure, I'm making sure that everybody's doing the training and that everybody has their policies in place. Because when something blows up, it just takes so much time. And so it's the only model I know where it's like, no, I really want you to be as low risk as I can get you. And that's not always possible. Stuff happens, but it makes a huge difference.
Right. And so same question then for the institutional clients who used to be paying for time. What has been their feedback on it?
You know what? They treat it more like a hire. They treat it more like they're hiring someone, like an employer. They're like, oh, was this a good hire? Was this a bad hire? Am I getting a good ROI for it? It's not that it's new. They just don't. They've done this so many times before, so they don't have such an emotional connection to it. They're like, well, look, I've hired lawyers before, or I'll hire lawyers after you. But no, this model works great. I'm happy with it. We're getting good value for our money, and we have a dedicated person to call. But for them, it's like, oh, who did I hire and why? When they look at the math, they're almost always pleased.
Right.
I haven't had anyone big, just because they have enough issues, especially in healthcare. Like once you get to 50 plus employees in California, you don't have like a target on your back, but a lot of, there's just enough employment issues that you're going to run into that they never, the lower end ones, the ones that are new, they worry, will I use this service as their biggest concern? The higher end ones are like, no, I know I'll use it. Do I get enough out of it? And then they'll do the math in their heads.
So, I mean, speaking of California law, though, is this a federal practice and a state practice? Like, how does that work in terms of the type of law that you have to be applying? And are you restricted to just clients in your state?
No, difficult question. Because, no, we have clients in other states because so many of the issues that we deal with are inherently federal. And what is more important is to understand how reimbursement arguments go as opposed to actual state law, because you're really not arguing over state law or even federal law for a lot of these reimbursement arguments. There are compliance arguments, there are documentation arguments. So, and a lot of the stuff is federal, but healthcare is just a nasty sort of complicated multi-jurisdictional field kind of no matter what. And even for the few clients that I have that are outside of California, they're all just thrilled. They're like, oh, somebody actually gets our practice. My main competitor are local business attorneys in the area of like, oh, no, we've had Phil forever. He bills us for the time. It's always appeared reasonable. So we're fine. And for those people, I'm like, nope, we're not a good fit. But like when you're trying to grow your practice and really up level, you like, for Christ's sake, you're in healthcare. You really need to have a dedicated person. Like, healthcare is scary. Like, I can't tell you how many people I know that have paid settlements for doing something on accident. I don't know of any other industry where you can screw up on accident as easily as you can in healthcare.
Right.
And so anyone that's serious sort of gets that. That's not a great answer to your question, but the people that are multi-state appreciate the experience much more than anything else. And if they're like I don't litigate. I've never litigated. I'm terrible at it, I'm sure, because I've never done it. And it's really easy as in-house to say, okay, great, let's just get a local lawyer and handle this issue. And I'll sit back seat and answer the questions that you don't want to ask them while they're on billable time.
So a question I like to ask of the actual other attorneys using the subscription model I have on the show is, what are the subscriptions that you pay for to power your subscription model? So like there are things obviously like if you're, you know, malpractice insurance, right, is like a subscription. But like, let's talk about like technology. Like what's like the technology focus on that?
So I use Zoho. I have a love-hate relationship with Zoho. Are you familiar with it?
I am. I looked into it originally when I was trying to find a CRM solution. Although I know they do a lot more than just that.
Yeah, it's like poor man's Salesforce. Like it can do anything that you want it to with customization, and you can find programmers and people all over the world. Like I haven't interacted with Salesforce a lot, but like the minimum, it's like 20, 40, 50 grand easy to customize it to make it do what you want. And I'm like, no, I don't have that. I'm not spending that, especially when I was brand new. And I liked Zoho because the reason why I didn't use Clio or anything else was just, it's not a case management. I have an ongoing relationship with these people. So I need the ability to do it on a project basis and then store the information. And I like Zoho for that. I don't know that it does document production well. And I would like to, so we may move to another system, but that's our main bread and butter. And then obviously everything's through a credit card. Everything is through Stripe. We're moving to Stacks. I'll let you know how that goes. I have my onboarding call with them and they're much cheaper. And my practice was below $1 million and Stacks, or excuse me, Stripe wouldn't give me a discount at all. I was like, come on, guys. Like, come on. This feels like a lot of money to me. Really? Are we doing this? Because Stripe does this stupid thing for subscriptions where they charge you, I think it's either 0.25 or 0.5% extra to have a subscription on there to bill someone monthly automatically. And I'm like, that's what are we doing here? That's ridiculous. So we're moving to Stacks. I'll let you know how that goes. But those are the two biggest ones that we have. We have our own online database that's with Google, but there are ways that we could be much more efficient. Because my career has always been so isolated as in-house counsel, I feel like I'm the least aware person when it comes to the tools that are out there. But this quarter, we are dedicated to getting that fixed. And in part, inspired by this podcast, because I'm like, ah, there are other people who are solving this problem. I listened to a couple of the podcasts that you've done, and they've been incredibly, incredibly helpful. We're making a database of literally all the things that they say so that we know what to investigate. And I'm just glad it's all in one spot. I don't have to go looking around for it.
You know, I'm happy to hear it's at least helping one lawyer out there.
Oh, helping the hell out of me. I don't know how many people are listening to this, but I have gotten great value out of this.
Great, great. I use Stripe as well, but I
Yep.
integrate Stripe with my client portal, which I use SweetDash. And
Okay.
SweetDash does some of the automations on the subscription side, so I'm not paying that extra percentage by just using Stripe
Got
directly.
it.
So I'm just paying whatever I pay I do an annual subscription for SweetDash, which is really low. Like, I think I got in on a deal. It's like $135 a year,
Oh my God.
but it's white label and it's HIPAA compliant. You could set up settings so it's HIPAA compliant. And this is not an ad for SweetDash, though I should probably include in the show notes. I probably have an affiliate link. I probably have an affiliate link. They don't sponsor the show, but affiliate link so I could get a kickback, I guess, in the show notes on SweetDash. So, because I'm going to say a little bit about it. So then that, but it's white label, but it's also like a blank canvas. It's like if you've ever looked at Notion, like you open up a Notion, if you don't use a template, it's like, well, I don't know, what do I do? So it does take a lot of customization, which is one of the reasons why it's so affordable. And they have upsells, you know, if you want to do certain things with it. And then, but even just $135 a year, I think it's $150 the plan I'm on, so it's not a huge savings, but I'm on a savings plan for it. Like I use some promo code, and it will process like the automatic subscription, so I'm only getting the 2.95 plus 30 cents per transaction is being taken out. So that's a workaround, but I've never heard of Stacks and I'm like a subscription expert, so I'm going to do a lot of Googling and see what I can figure out about Stacks.
It's $199 a month plus 10 cents a transaction. And then they just charge you whatever Visa charges. So if Visa's 1.5, they just pass along the 1.5 and 10 cents, and then they have a flat fee, which I love. The only other thing that we use a lot of is PandaDoc, mostly because it allows you to collect payment information and it will integrate directly with Stripe. I think it will do that with Stacks as well, but not having to have a pair, it's shockingly difficult to get someone's credit card information. Like, I thought it would just be a phone call that's like 30 seconds. I am wrong. That is not true.
So I also not a sponsor, at least not at the time of this recording, though I'm going to edit this in the future if I get them to sponsor the show, because I just became a client of theirs and there's a lot of potential synergy. Is Gravity Legal does. Actually, I think Stripe is 2.9% plus 30 cents. Gravity Legal just does 2.95% flat, no plus 30 cents per transaction. And you could set up subscriptions in their platform, and that's just part of their platform. And so if you haven't invested too much in Stacks already, it might be worth looking into because they will automate your subscriptions for you. So definitely look into that and enter sponsorship here if I actually get them to sponsor the show. Probably the code is law subscribed for 10 for some sort of benefit of signing up. I don't know how that works, how that would work. But so something else is I would also be remiss while we're in a semi-sponsored segment. If you're looking at document automation, you know, Gavel is a sponsor of the show. Law subscribed saves you 10% off your first, you know, annual subscription. Have you looked into like a document automation type platform like that or one of their competitors?
No, but that's our next step. And I think that's what every subscription law firm goes through is that for me, the first question was, wait, is this a model? Is this a thing? Or is this an aberration that I can't actually build a business on? And once we got to a certain point, I was like, ah, okay, great. This is a model. Okay, fantastic. And then the first thing I had and the process for me is, how do I make my job easier so that I'm not pulling my hair out all the time? And we've done 75% of that easily. And now my next question is, okay, great. How do I make my paralegals' lives easier? Because the easier and more efficient I can make their lives and their job, the more revenue we can take on. And with a straight face, tell the client, no, we have availability, because the knucklehead stuff is handled. And so we don't have to do any customization. And what I like about the idea of document automation is just, it means that the errors just go down, not to zero, but pretty close. And it means that I can review it with so much more confidence. So that's our next stage. Gavel.
Gavel.io at the time
Got
of
it.
recording. I'm sure they'll get .com eventually. And that's for your documents you bring, right? Like my other sponsor, 650, is I might not even include an ad spot in this since I'm talking about them in the interview. I mean, it is important to talk about these things. So like 650 is business and employment law documents, and they do every single state. So while I don't think that it's specific to the medical industries, I do wonder if there's some potential overlap there for if like you needed a document that you didn't have. 650 does both. They do a monthly or annual subscription that you could get access to all their documents in whichever category. But then also they just do one-off documents. So like if you just need it, this type of handbook, thing for this state. You know, they do those one-off documents that includes an automation with the purchase of that document. And so like there's optionality out there. And I'm so happy they sponsor the show because like subscription attorneys need to be efficient with their time. So if you have the document, Gavel's good for you. If you don't have the document and it's applicable for employment or business, 650 is good for you as a starting point, right? So like, there are tools out there. I think there's another one. I can't remember what they're called, but like even like Clio and some of these other platforms, MyCase, they've acquired document automation platforms that are also part of their platforms too. So there's a lot of options now than there's ever been before. And it's kind of a necessity when you're not billing your time to make things go as quickly as possible.
And the client wants it. It's one of those odd things where it's like, no, it's actually good for the industry. It's good for the client. It actually makes sense for everybody. Whenever I get on this topic, I try hard not to get irritated, because I'm like, oh, it's essentially unethical, criminal that people haven't moved. Not criminal, but like, it's just, it drives me nuts that it's like, wait a second, we've been sending people packets of board meeting minutes and bylaws that no one will ever read, ever. And they just this creation of make work, which drives me insane. Like, who wants to do that for their life?
When I went solo, I pivoted from mostly litigation to a transactional-only practice. I did not have a database of documents to automate. That's why a business and employment legal document database and automation tool like 650 is super useful. I can rely on the quality of the documents in 650's database since they're putting excellent legal minds to work curating and updating their documents and automations over time. When you're not billing by the hour, outsourcing and efficiency matters, and 650 can help you scale your practice to get high-quality documents drafted in less time. Use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED at 650.com and when being onboarded to get 10% off. If you're not a business and employment attorney, or you have your own documents that you'd prefer to use, then my next sponsor, Gavel, is the automation tool for you. Gavel allows you to build shareable, client-facing workflow and document automations. In other words, Gavel helps you create a legal practice where attorneys can monetize the value they bring clients in productized form at scale via subscriptions and flat fees. Use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED at gavel.io to get 10% off an annual subscription. There's no one right way to automate and scale your practice, but with one or both of my sponsors, 650 and Gavel, you can take your subscription law firm to the next level. Links to both in the show notes. Now back to the show.
And I have not widely distributed this yet, but I will send you a link to my talk at Tech Show about the subscription model. And the last part I talk about it is ethics. It's my ABA Tech Show talk. And I make the case there, sort of what you said, where to be billing your time the way attorneys are doing it is probably unethical if you actually think about it.
Absolutely. It's not probably, in my view, absolutely it is. For a couple of reasons. I've had CEOs or bosses that I've referred attorneys to, And they could just hear the attorney salivating on the other line, thinking of an industry-wide enforcement on a particular issue. And they, because how can you not? Because your fiscal quarter is tied to a DOJ enforcement action across an industry, you know it's going to generate a ton of work for you. And to even just that like slight wish that your client comes to ill so that you can bill for so much just feels so gross. Like it feels terrible. Like, why don't you want to be on the other side of it? Especially when you're a business and regulatory attorney anyway. Like you're not litigating. And for some things, you have to do hourly. For some things, contingency make a wonderful amount of sense. But for business advice, I just to me, it's like, wait a second, you're a huge multi-billion dollar law firm. You're telling me that it's impossible to figure out on a per matter or per client basis how much work they're going to do over a year? Are you insane? Are you kidding me? Like, get three kids from MIT. They could do it over a lunch hour. And to me that seems unethical. To me, that seems insane that we haven't pushed ourselves as an industry to get to that point. But my favorite thing that Alex Su has ever posted is a Darth Vader killing a bunch of rebels, and the billable hour is labeled as his lightsaber. And it's because it's excellent. It's truly, I'm like, they should have awards for memes. And maybe they do. They probably do. I just don't know about them. But it was excellent because, like a lightsaber, it is effective, it is simple, everybody understands it, and it cuts through everything. And God, it is so hard to kill. It is very difficult to get rid of the billable hour.
And I would say that while there may be some things where you think the billable hour is the best way to do it, I still feel like you could find a way to not do it with the billable hour. You know, even some situations like litigation, subscription plus flat fee, I think could totally replace a billable hour. You just have to be strategic with how you implement it. And success fees, mediation fees, settlement fees versus having to go to trial type fees. So I think like you have different flat fees based on that. You let the client know before they sign up. They know exactly what they're going to pay. It just depends on how long it takes to get to trial. But there are incentives to get to trial faster for the attorney. So like there are ways. I think there are
Oh,
ways.
absolutely, there are ways. And on top of that, clients appreciate and I think understand that. Like, it's an insane relationship to say, hey, you and I are going to work together. And I don't really know how long this is going to take, but I'm just going to keep billing you until it's done. And I'm like, no, obviously, we're not doing that's insane. You're obviously incentivized to make it more complicated for it to take longer. And then when I yell and scream at you'll find a resolution. Like, obviously that's what's going to occur.
So let's talk about your actual model. So you have at least on your website, which you're now one of, I think, you know, six or seven of us attorneys that actually list their prices on their website. So kudos to you for doing that. And you've, like you've mentioned, it's changed. It's changed over the years, but you do list your membership plans, and you have three different plans that you at least market. Because I'll make custom things for my clients if they need
For
it. But
sure.
you market these three different plans, and so tell us how you came to that, and like and is it really that simple? It's like the premium, the practice purchase, the practice sale, and that's it.
So I do a lot of transitions, or excuse me, a lot of transactions for dental. And that's where most of my flat fee transactional work actually comes from. And I did that by looking at the market. I had done one or two. And then I could not figure out why the market was charging 6,000 to like 10,000. I'm like, these are pretty straightforward transactions. I'm pretty sure I can train a paralegal to do quite a bit of this. And so I just went 25% off of what everybody else was doing. Like every flat fee attorney, I've been burned on that a few times, but to be honest, not that bad. Like even still, if I'm off by like 20%, then I'm off by 20%. Everybody has troublesome clients sometimes. For me, we start our plans at 950 for the monthly. And the way I approached it, and I go back and forth on this all the time as to should I offer a limited plan that sets out the amount of work in advance versus just having unlimited. In general, I almost always prefer to do unlimited. I like it because it says to the client, hey, look, I'm going to trust you. You're going to trust me. If we have something where we have grossly miscalculated, we're going to talk about it in 3 to 6 months, and we'll figure that out between the two of us. But all of my plans. So while I list some pricing on my website, Right now, we're doing customized pricing for everybody once I get them on the phone and I figure out the scope and the size of their practice and what industry. So, for instance, I will charge someone who has an ABA practice less than I will for somebody who does, or for, who's a just a podiatrist, for interest, for instance, because ABA practices rely a huge amount on these very low paid ABA therapists that not terribly low paid, but they're only like 20, 25 bucks an hour, like not huge amounts of money, and their margins are razor thin. So for them to get big, they just really, and they mostly have HR issues more than they have healthcare issues. And so I can customize it a little bit per industry. Alcohol, drug, and rehab, it's complicated. It's just complicated. And so they actually end up getting charged a little bit more. So I have sort of a nuanced pricing scheme that sort of starts there. But I like to at least say that, like, hey, look, we're going to be between 950 and 6,000 bucks on the very high end. After 6 or 7,000, I'm like, you're getting to a point where you got to hire someone in the house. But the reason why I like the simplicity of an all-inclusive plan is because of the relationship that it lets me set with my clients. When I see models that are you do a certain number of projects per month, I think the client wonders, well, what happens if I don't do those projects per month? Are you still going to keep the money? Like, what if I don't generate enough work for you? And I don't, yeah. So I wrestle with that kind of a lot. This is where I sat because it mimics the in-house model that I'm used to, and I like that in-house relationship. Yeah, I don't know, but I keep going back and forth on it. Do you keep going back and forth on it too?
Yeah, so I mean, because I'm doing like you're still charging a premium, but you're representing doctors, mental health, medical, professionals. So you should charge a high amount. I charge $20 a month, and I do unlimited scheduled calls because I also don't employ any staff. And so it's just very different right now for my premium subscribers and up, and my freelancer and business subscribers, they get access to way more scheduled call availability than the entry level. The entry level get access to like right now it's 2.5 hours a day, but that's been less and that's been more. And right now I'm at 2.5 hours. So it just it just I have not had anybody abuse it yet. But because it comes down to reasonableness, right? And I don't know what the ethics are for California specifically, but like the model rules, it comes down to is the fee reasonable in light of all the things? And $20, I think unquestionably is reasonable, right? And so for yours,
Unquestionably.
right, for everything else in totality of, and I say in the intro, there's no ethical advice and legal advice given, but like just non-legal opinion, I have to imagine like looking at your website and seeing all the things when you click on view details that you're offering per month. If 1 month they use all of it and the next month they use none of it and it goes on and off for every month like that, I still have to imagine they're getting a fantastic deal. It seems reasonable to me.
Oh, bud, to me, not, I am so far away from unreasonable. I almost want someone to come to me and say, hey, Ebbies, do an ethics probe. I'm like, are you kidding me? Let's talk about how many projects and how many phone calls I have been on with this
Right,
owner.
right.
They're almost always getting a screaming deal, a screaming deal. And like, even if there are one or two isolated areas where somebody in theory could get an unreasonable fee under subscription, I'm like, you really have to set this up in a very specific way, even to, I think, get close to that.
Right.
Because especially when you compare it with those that are working on contingency, those that are working on getting their attorney's fees via statute, via litigation, I think we're so far away from that. Plus, like, just survey my clients. They're just like, no, I can get a hold of Matt. And not everybody, sometimes we make people do scheduled calls versus unscheduled, depending upon how much they're paying. And we're getting a little bit better about enforcing that. But I think to me, the idea that subscription could even approach unethical fees, it's like, well, from the examples that I've seen or unreasonable fees, from the examples I've seen, not even close, like not even in a million years. But don't worry, when a big firm finally gets on the subscription model, I'm sure they will figure out a way to extract an unethical amount of fees from someone. I am certain that's just right around the corner. As soon as somebody with an MBA like starts it.
Yeah, I mean the problem with that though is Atrium was like a Y Combinator startup that they tried to do subscriptions at scale for the institutional big law clients, and it didn't work. And so I think the subscription model is well served by solo and small firms better, which I think really disrupts big law. And I don't know that big law can do what it does. You know what I'm saying? And so I really see, I actually see the subscription model, like associates looking at the subscription model and saying, do I need to make tens of millions of dollars a year? Or is a couple millions of dollars a year okay, and I could be in, I could have work-life balance, right? So I really see the subscription model in the future completely disrupting the big law model.
You're talking to a guy here that's never worked in big law, but for, so take that for what it's worth. I would like to see subscriptions scale. Like that's my goal. Mm-hmm. My goal is we're growing the firm is growing. Like it's not nuts. Like it's manageable, but mm-hmm. we'll probably hire an attorney this year. And how I hope to sell it to them is to say, hey, you can have a life that we're not litigating. There aren't that many deadlines. Very straightforward. You know, it's in-house counsel, so a lot of variety. But the types of questions are pretty straightforward, except for like the funky healthcare ones. But that's mm-hmm. fine. That's any healthcare attorney is going to deal with that. I really think more than anything that it is scalable. And I think it can get to a big loss status, meaning that like somebody small could grow this really big. If anybody was like truly thoughtful in big law, they would buy out one of these ones that could show that they could scale and build it almost as a separate practice. Cause for me, I think the success of the model only happens when there's enough people who take it on mm-hmm. and make enough money on it that it gets that's when we'll actually see the tipping point.
Right.
You know, it's when, what was it? When Best Buy did Geek Squad.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember if they were the first or second, but like once they did their giant marketing push for that, everybody else could start similar practices or similar business models. Cause like, well, Best Buy's doing it. And it hasn't, I don't know who has to take it on to make that big of a piece or that mm-hmm. big of a shift. Mm-hmm. I'll be fascinated to see when it happens.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that is a big monumental task to scale to something like that, but it's built right into the model.
Yeah.
Scale. So, I mean, I suppose it can happen. And also, for what it's worth, if any big law attorneys are listening, I'm not opposed to my firm being acquired.
I would also like to have my firm be acquired for a very high premium. Just want to put that set expectations out. It seems stupid to not do it. It's like, wait a second, big law should be the one. People with large amounts of money should be the ones doing this because they can really invest in innovation in a way mm-hmm. like I just don't have $1 million to throw at a system.
Right.
They could, that's a rounding error for some of these firms.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems crazy that they haven't jumped onto it, but I appreciate where I appreciate the risk aversion because it helps me out, leaves plenty of room for me to play in.
Right.
But then number two of like, yeah, well, if it's working this way, you know, it's like that lightsaber. It's effective. It's been around forever mm-hmm. and everybody understands it.
Right.
And
although big law will never come after the clients that you're serving because it's not enough money on a subscription, right? So like you and I are safe because we're serving long unserved markets.
Yeah. Yeah. No one cares about doctors. I say that with tongue in cheek, but like very few large law firm practices, they just don't have the bandwidth because they can't figure out how to bill $30,000 out of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, no. You actually only want to bill $12,000 to $15,000 out of them and do some proactive things. And you can actually get great ROI mm-hmm. and still serve the client well. And they're thrilled with you. And the fact that they keep missing out on it is because they have just this bloated infrastructure that they have to support. And right. when you don't have that anymore, it's awesome. So I don't know if we'll ever sell Provider Legal, but if we do, I'll be interested to see if it's from a big law or somebody who has, I don't know, like somebody who's in private, you know, personal injury law or something like that. Maybe mm-hmm. Morgan will buy me.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to move into a new industry.
Yeah. I mean, I have a way to disrupt that, but that's for another podcast episode. Yours is the true, like pure subscription model, right? You don't have add-ons, you don't have subscription add-ons or flat fees, or like, do you, like, how do you do that if you do?
No, we do flat fee for transactions. When I've had an attorney refer me a case and the expectation is hourly, I've done a couple of hourly projects per year. I regret it every time.
Mm-hmm.
I regret it. Putting together an invoice for me is like pulling out my toenails. Like, it's just like, oh God, who wants to keep track? That was the other thing, by the way, why I started this, because I looked at people and like I looked at those big law firm associates and like, your life is terrible. Your life is like, yeah, you got to go on a vacation to Mauritius and you got to pay for that, and that was awesome. But like, other than that, you're back at work at 9 because you took a 6 to 8 break for dinner. That's stupid. Like, you're gonna die in 40 years, as we all are. Like, I'm 40. I'm lucky if I live another 40, 50. Like, that's not how I'm spending life.
Right. So
Yeah.
you I mean, so then I mean, pure subscription for the model is a great
Yeah,
way to go if
pure
you could do it.
subscription.
Yeah, if you could do that, that's great. Mine is, I have some versions of that, but mine is like fully unbundled, and then you bundle back in with flat fee services, but it's just a different market. So, and speaking of that, like I've had attorneys on here who are doing it for like the access to justice approach. And well, it's kind of what you're doing, because these doctors might have been priced out of certain legal services in the past for something that you're providing, but by letting them more affordably offload their legal stuff onto you, you're saving lives, Matt.
I mean, that's what we tell people. No, the doctors do all the work. For me, it's, yeah. So to answer your last question, which I didn't quite get to, no, we don't do any hourly work. Very rarely, if ever. I don't love the add-on model for my client base, because for my client base, they're all nervous and anxious and they need help. And for them, the ongoing relation, at least what I believe, is that the ongoing relationship is more important than having sort of the menu of services to pick from. And a lot of times they don't know what the heck it is they need or want. And so they're, I don't want people to buy things they don't need to buy. And for me, the main pitch I tell doctors is like, look, if I can reduce your stress by like 10 or 15%, I think that's worth 10 grand a year, no questions asked. And almost everybody agrees with you with that, because it is stressful. Like, it's difficult to treat patients that don't want to be treated a lot of times in the first place, which in mental health happens a lot. And then to add insurance reimbursement concerns, like, are you crazy? That's a lot of stress. And if I can help them just reduce stress by 10, 15%, so they can put their energy to, hey, what trauma treatment program can I figure out for this client base? You know what? I have a lot of people with sexual assault. Like, how do I, like, that's where I want their brain. And that's what they're excellent at. I just want them to do what they're best at. So if we can help in any way in that, even tangentially, I'd be thrilled.
Yeah, I love it. So I often ask this question of my guests, but they also don't look like me. And so whether or not you want to leave this question in here, sort of up to you. This is my DEI question. My like,
Sure.
you know, it's mostly attorneys who don't look like you and me, who are using the subscription model and disrupting the billable hour. And you know, it's hard to, when it's two white guys talking to each other, not sound a little bit like mansplaining a little bit. But like I'm so happy to platform innovative attorneys who don't look like me most of the time. And I think you and I and maybe two others out there make four white guys that are using the subscription model and disrupting the billable hour. But I would still like to get your input on it. I mean, I know you went in-house to your own practice, but you know, why do you think it is that, you know, like these big law firms, they can't retain women and attorneys of color, and so these attorneys are leaving and they're innovating with the legal profession. Like, what's your perspective on that, and why the subscription model? And if they're listening to this, why they should use the subscription model as a way to obtain, you know, obtain a good work-life balance?
Well, a couple things. One, if they are going out there on their own, I'd be thrilled to talk with anyone that wants to talk about this topic, because A, it's fascinating and interesting, but B, if you need help, there are lots of resources. This podcast is an excellent resource, but I hope that there's as much community built around this as possible. I think people that jump to the subscription model, regardless of their background, are because they haven't, for one reason or another, been well served by the legal profession. Like, it didn't work for them. So, like, for me, I was a little bit of an older student. I was married, had kids. Like, I needed a job. Like, I needed this to work. I could not screw around and take on debt and not pay that back right away. And I didn't go to the best law school because it was more cost effective. I had a scholarship, et cetera. So like, I'm not a good fit for like 22 years old, just graduated from a great school that went into law school. So for anyone that doesn't feel like they fit in well with the legal profession, sort of lockstep, standard issue, big law sort of path. I think this works as a really wonderful, really wonderful alternative to where you can serve clients well. And there's a huge part of the legal community that actually really care about their clients. And I think if you do care a lot about the people that you're interested in serving, subscription works incredibly well. Mm-hmm. And I think for those that haven't been served well by the legal community, that's why they, as employees or as partners or as leader, and they're not recognized for how smart or how thoughtful they are. Like that's the beauty of the system we have is, well, forget it. I'm going to go out and start my own thing. And guess what? Turns out sales aren't that hard. Like sales aren't that hard. I guarantee, like, that's the thing that like most attorneys are afraid of. Like, well, how do I get clients? Buddy, half of the people you buy cars from are on meth. They figured it out. You can too. I promise you. I promise you, you can figure this out. It's not that scary. Like that's the thing though, is that like partners at firms, they have these relationships cultivated from years of interacting within a high net worth individual community. Well, I didn't come from a high net worth individual community. I have 7 brothers and 2 sisters. Like, didn't matter how much money dad was making. Split 12 ways is not a whole lot. If you don't fit in with that crowd, which very few people do, like, don't try. Like, they're a terrible crowd to be with anyway. Come over to the subscription side. It is a interested community that really wants to help you out. So I think people of color, women, aren't served in that way for any variety of those reasons. And of course, they're going to gravitate to something else that works.
Right, right. So non-traditional student,
yep,
is what you were, and also first generation lawyer in the family?
Yeah, I was the first one. I'm the first non-engineer, non-scientist in my family. I was the first Stevens to not understand how math works.
Well, that's what tech tools are for, right?
Yeah, that's what I've heard. That other people could figure it out though. I'm glad I don't have to. But if you're like, but that's my point, is that the legal profession is so homogenous that if you're like outside the standard deviation by like a little bit, you're on the outside,
mm-hmm,
by far. And I can't imagine what that feels like for people of color or for women in the legal profession. Like, God, if I feel a little outside, you must feel way out in the cold.
Right.
But don't worry. The warm, loving arms of subscription legal services are here for you.
Right.
What I would say.
Right. And I do have this hypothesis that also all the attorneys using the subscription model are first generation attorneys, because that's like, that's my thing. Is like, yeah, I have no other attorneys in the family. I'm the very first one. Most of my family has been in sales or law enforcement, but not legal services. So, you know, so I think I'm able to come at it from a different angle as well, for that reason, that I don't have the functional fixedness of this is the way it's always been done. So we'll see. You're the first guest I've remembered to ask that question to, a first gen attorney or not.
Oh yeah, no, definitely first gen attorney. But I think also having been in-house counsel for so long, like no one told me, like a few people told me that this was weird. And I felt like it was a little weird because I didn't see that many other people doing it. Mm-hmm. And that feels isolating more than anything. But well, once you get into it, you realize like, oh, this is clearly superior. Like this is, it's like when you drive a nice car for the first time and you're like, oh, so the engine's not supposed to like give a bunch of racket every time you start the engine. Oh, that's weird. That's a new experience.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great analogy. And I don't think we're going to get better than that. My last question for you, speaking of weird, is a hot dog a sandwich and why?
No, it clearly cannot be a sandwich, because a sandwich is defined as two pieces of bread, whereas a hot dog is clearly joined by one piece of bread. It's folded. It's more akin to a taco. It's one piece of bread. And in fact, if it splits down the middle, you're pissed every time because the fillings now drop out. So clearly a hot dog could not be a sandwich. It has to be more akin to a taco, because a sandwich has to have two pieces of bread to be defined as a sandwich. That's my thought.
Okay. Okay.
I have clear feelings on this. I've thought about this.
Yes. Yeah. And as we go more and more into Law Subscribed, I like to ask some follow-up questions. What about an open-faced sandwich? Is that a sandwich?
Oh, good question. I don't know if it's defined as a sandwich, but it's how I prefer to eat sandwiches, because I don't need the extra carbs. Like I'm approaching 40. I gotta limit that.
So is it then like badly named open face sandwich has the name sandwich in it, but it's not a sandwich?
I mean, since I've doubled down pretty hard on the idea that you need two pieces of bread to be a sandwich, I think I logically have to agree with that premise. I don't love that I've put myself in this corner, but that's where I am, so I'll defend it
It's
because it's not really a sandwich. It's just a piece of bread with toppings. It's really what are those called when you have like a cracker with cheese and sandwiches? There like cheese and meat on it, other than a Lunchable? Is there like a term for that?
I don't think so.
Whatever that term is, though, just the gargantuan version of that is what you're eating, not technically a sandwich.
Like a charcuterie something.
It's extraordinary charcuterie. That's or gargantuan charcuterie. I don't know. We're gonna work with marketing. They'll figure out a better name.
Open face sandwich, not a sandwich. Because it, well, because here's the thing, if you follow that logic, is pizza a sandwich?
Unless folded, of course not. It's it's
Unless
it's it's
folded.
unless folded, in which case, but I think it has to be eaten. Like no one eats a sandwich sideways, so it truly has to be up and down. I think that's really what it is that defines it. So I don't think a pizza can be, because you can eat it at any angle, really.
These are why people like this is the reason people tune into Law Subscribed. Matt Stevens, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. If anyone wants to follow up with you, where's the best way for them to do that?
Shoot me an email at mstevens, mstevens, at providerlegal.com. Happy to chat with all people to talk about subscription law services. It's what I end up thinking about most of my day anyway.
Awesome. Thanks again for coming on the show.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks again to 650 and Gavel for sponsoring this show. The best way for others to discover this show is for you to share it with someone you think would find a value from it. Follow me on LinkedIn, since that's where I'm most active on social media, and click the bell towards the top right of my profile to get notified about all of my posts about this podcast and everything else I think is valuable for you to see. To get in touch, message me on LinkedIn or email kurbis@lawsubscribed.com. All links are in the show notes. Until next time, this is Matthew Kurbis with Law Subscribed.